Okay, for those of you listening on WTPR, thank you for being here. We are in chapter 30 of Patriarchs and Prophets. This particular chapter is based on Exodus chapter 25 all the way through to 40, and Leviticus chapter 4 and 16. And I think I may have already said the title, but if I didn't, it's called The Tabernacle and Its Services. Let me expand the lettering a little bit here so I can read it with these old eyeballs. There we go. Well, they're not that old, but, you know, they have been damaged. So. All right. Starting right off. Oh, endures here. Sabbath blessings to you, sister. And everybody else that came in that I missed. All right. The command was communicated to Moses while in the mount with God. Let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them. And full directions were given for the construction of the tabernacle. There is, right there, I mean, the sanctuary itself, if you want to know a lot. Hey, James, how you doing, brother? Sabbath blessings to you. If you want to know a lot about God and future events, what happened on Calvary, the sanctuary, the studying the sanctuary itself is just an amazing study. It's an adventure. And it's not one that you could study once. I did it once, and I did like a somewhat basic job of it explaining, and I used an outline from another ministry. I gave them credit on that, my sanctuary page. I followed an outline that they were running. And because they're pictures, they had some pictures, which I used them. And but like the Bible, you could study the sanctuary over and over and over and over again and still keep on getting blessed. And that's why I like Sarah Peck's book, because she, I think that's what Bonnie just put in the room there. Is that the Sarah Peck's book, Bonnie, The Path there? Is that what that was? Yep, The Path to the Throne of God. That's on my site. That's a huge book. It was written. She is Sarah Peck. I can't remember. I got a link. Yeah, that's, I do have a link right there on there where you click it. It explains who she is. If I remember correctly, she was associated with Sister White. And when I first got her book, the story that I got, it was an Adventist minister that handed me the book and told me it's extremely important to read. And what he told me was, the way she wrote the book was so that she can explain the sanctuary in all its nooks and crannies, even the little nails that are in the wood. She was going to explain every bit of the sanctuary to little kids, to children. And to this day, men of God use her book to teach it, to teach the sanctuary, because it's just chock full of everything that you need to know. Oh, wow, just popped up on my screen. It's a little slow. Sarah Peck, indoor. Sarah Peck, just click that blue thing where it says Sarah Peck, and you'll find out who she be. It's on the site. I've got her actual physical book in my hand, but Bonnie found me that, I think it was Bonnie, either that or Fiber Girl. Somebody found it for me. The actual book, I've had it for years. It's not an easy book to put down, you know. It's kind of like Desire of Ages, where it's just like, you just picture yourself there. And just, I mean, she describes it so well. Online, anywhere. You can get it anywhere. Like, I'm sure at Amazon.com would have the book, too. You can buy it just about anywhere. I don't think you're going to find it in Christian bookstores. Just like you go to any Christian bookstore, you're not going to find anything from Ellen White. You get, and that amazes me, how much the people are blinded out there. The Lord has a prophet for every age. Ellen White happens to be the one for the end time age, right? In the last days, your daughter shall prophesy. She's one of them. And I've been buying Bible software for years. I haven't done it recently because I'm more or less, I got what I need. And even with eSword, They got a whole list of commentaries that you can download and put on their stuff, right? Or you can go to a Christian bookstore and you can buy, because I've done this a few times. I got the Bible on DVD or Bible on CD or whatever, or on audio tapes. And they give you a choice of all these different commentaries that you can have downloaded to it. Not one of them is from Ellen White. Not one. A little suspicious, isn't it? The most prolific writer, you know, the most prolific female writer or woman writer, however you want to put it without being male chauvinist about it. And yet, in Bible writer and Bible commentary, and thought to be a prophet by millions, but yet you won't find her in any Christian bookstore. Why? Well, it's obvious. When you read her writings, that's why it's so, you know, and I've run into two guys already that this has happened to, and it was nothing I did. One of them used to come in the audio chat. I don't know if he still does. I can't remember who it was, but he told me, he says he ran into, someone gave him a book. They both had the same story, more or less. They received a book from somebody, but the book had the front cover ripped off of it, along with the preface and the back cover only. So he did not know who wrote the book. But he says whenever he was down and having a rough go, he'd go into that book and start reading it. And then one day when the internet came to town, he decided to start putting in little bits and pieces of the book to see if he could find it anywhere. And both these guys happened to run across, and I hardly have anything on my website about Ellen White. Reason being is because people get in my face about it, and it's, you know, I stick with the Bible because they can't confront, they can't refute, they can't rebuke it, you know? They try to twist and do whatever they can in Ellen White's writing, so rather than to avoid the situation. Although I have put a lot more on recently. But both these guys says they put them on the internet and they found her writings on my website and they found out who she was. They didn't know that they were reading the book Desire of Ages, both of them. I thought that was so amazing. And they were so blessed by it. If people just put off all the stuff that they've been told, because I was told for many, many years the Seventh-day Adventists were a cult. I was Catholic, of course, so that should be expected. But I don't, you know, now that I researched their doctrinal stand, I found out that the Catholic Church is the cult and all the other churches are cultic in their doctrines. Because if you look at the Seventh-day Adventist Church in its infancy, when it was in the ninth hour, it's the prophesied, you know, church for that time, for the ninth hour. It was not a cult. Today, it's got some cultic issues. Yeah, it's doing Trinity stuff. It's got a lot of weird stuff about the Godhead now, and it's just, so that's why many of us are here, stepped out of the church because of what's been going on. Anyway, getting back. Sure went off a little bit off the deep end there just from mentioning the word tabernacle, but, you know. Continuing. By their apostasy, the Israelites forfeited the blessing of the divine presence and for the time rendered impossible the erection of a sanctuary for God among them. But after they were again taken into favor with heaven, the great leader proceeded to execute the divine command. Chosen men were especially endowed by God with skill and wisdom for the construction of the sacred building. Ever think about that? Because I did that once when I was, you know, because these guys were blessed with, you know, the carvings and stuff like that. I was, because I'm an artist and I was thinking about, but I'm not an artist that I would fashion myself next to someone else and that I consider a true artist. Like my daughter, my oldest daughter, she has this gift, and she can do. She can draw these things and form these things out of clay. That just, I can more or less draw similar to the way she does it, but it takes me forever. And she'll just like, you know, with a pen, and it's done. It's like, how do you do that? You know, I just can't. And it's just, and she can't explain how she does it either, because it's a gift. It's from on high. It's just like certain other things. Like some of us have an ability to balance. Other people can't walk down the street without falling down. Or some people can talk. Or some people can sing. How's that? You know, there's people out there that are tone deaf and they don't even know it. It's these blessings that the Lord gives. And this is what happened here. Some of these guys were with skill and wisdom for the construction of the sacred building. I mean, they were purposely handpicked by the Heavenly Father to do this particular job. And then when you think forward, you think, what am I here for? You know, what we are here for? Look at what you can do. Look at what excites you. Look at what you desire. There's no mistake that the desire is there. I was just in prayer the other day about that. There's certain desires I want to do. You know, certain things that I want to do for the Lord. And it's a deep, deep rooted desire. It's not what you think. It's, you know, it's just, well, the main, like one of the things, you know, everybody always says, you know, one of the best gifts, of course, to be a prophet. But then what do we need a prophet for in today's age? You know, if we just understand prophecy, that's good enough. But laying on of hands. Because we've seen those miracles so many times in this family. But it would be such an amazing thing to be able to just walk up to these little kids or even adults that are dying and just see their eyes light up with healing behind them. Oh, man. And that's a desire, right? That's something that's just, I mean, it's such a strong desire. You dream about something like that. How can that be a mistake? How can a desire like that be a mistake? So I'm thanking the Lord in advance because I know one day I'll have that blessing to see that happen. Because He's the one who created me. That desire is there, so, you know, there's a reason for it. I didn't create the desire. You know? Something that just happened. It's just like, what turns your light on? Think about it. What can you do for the Lord? So continuing, God Himself gave to Moses the plan of that structure with particular directions as to its size and form, the materials to be employed, and every article of furniture which it was to contain. The holy places made with hands were to be figures of the true patterns of the things in the heavens. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 24 and 23. That seems a bit strange. It'd go back and forth like that. Maybe that's a page. Oh, no, it's not a page number. Anyway, going on, it says, a miniature representation of the heavenly temple where Christ, our great high priest, after offering his life as a sacrifice, was to minister in the sinner's behalf. God presented before Moses in the mount a view of the heavenly sanctuary and commanded him to make all things according to the pattern shown him. All these directions were carefully recorded by Moses, who communicated them to the leaders of the people. For the building of the sanctuary, great and expensive preparations were necessary. A large amount of the most precious and costly material was required. Yet the Lord accepted only free will offerings. Let me stop there for a minute. Those of us who are praying to do certain things where it's going to cost a few dollars. Case in point, as many of you know, we are particularly praying right now to be able to go state to state and just spread the gospel. We have, I can't remember the exact total, it's like 240 families in the United States, you know, proper in those states that are looking for a church that teaches like we do. I have a little page on the website called Needs Church, or Do You Need a Church kind of a thing, and they fill it out. And I'd like to, or someone in our gathering, it'd be nice if we had like a motor home. That way, and the reason I say a motor home is because air flight is extremely expensive, and you're locked into the area you're going to. Sure, you can rent a car and maybe cruise a couple, 3 hours down the road that way, but then you got to go 3 hours back and get back to that crazy airport where you can't even put your Suave shampoo in a little vial or whatever weird rules are they got. But if you got a Winnebago, and not so much a Winnebago, just, I found one of these small ones, you can go state to state and go anywhere, you know, like set up a path to go around. But think about the way He's building the sanctuary here. Our Father owns a cattle on a thousand hills. If this is His will, it'll get done. If not, fine. He's got something else to do. I mean, look at the way we're able to communicate now. We're able to go around the world sharing our faith, and I don't even have to leave my house. So right now, this is extremely attractive method of evangelization, okay? I mean, I've been doing it. This is one of the reasons I started the website, because I saw the potential to be able to reach a lot more, a lot quicker. When I used to do the street preaching, you know, I still do it whenever I get a chance. I'm a little unorthodox in my methods in way. I'll do it anywhere. I don't just set out to do street preaching. If I'm out shopping for food, I might have an opportunity. I'll go for it. But internet, I'm sleeping. I'm snoring away. I'm upstairs sawing wood. And homeless people are on my website reading about Jesus and the truth and finding out where the trouble is in this planet when it comes to Antichrist. And being able to have the information that they need that's not being shared on their pulpits. The information on the website, I've yet to find anybody that says, oh, yeah, my preacher or my pastor or my priest, they talk about this every week. You know, never. I've been doing this, what, 8-9 years online? Not once has anybody ever told me that they heard what we share on their pulpits, unless, of course, they're like a separated type Seventh-day Adventist. But continuing, of every man that giveth it willingly with his heart, he shall take my offering, was the divine command repeated by Moses to the congregation. Devotion to God and the spirit of sacrifice were the first, in today's world it would be prerequisite, but I guess she says requisite in preparing a dwelling place for the Most High. Okay, let me scroll down a little bit here. All the people responded with one accord. They came, everyone whose heart stirred him up, and everyone whom his spirit made willing, and they brought the Lord's offering to the work. Notice how they say the Lord's offering? It's just like with tithings. It's not yours. So quit holding on with, you know, with white knuckles. The work's got to get done. If you don't have any opportunities or, like, let's just, because there are people out there that don't have certain abilities that others have, but they do have abilities that the others don't have. You know what I mean? Like some people that can't help in one way can help in another way. And being on this planet as it is, it's all going to take money irregardless. Okay, requisites equal abilities. Okay, thanks. So, backtracking a little bit here, she's quoting, of course, it says, they came, everyone whose heart stirred him up, everyone whom his spirit made willing, and they brought the Lord's offering to the work of the tabernacle of the congregation and for all his service and for the holy garments. And they came, both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted, and brought bracelets and earrings and rings and tablets, all jewels of gold, and every man that offered offering an offering of gold unto the Lord. And we all know where they got all that stuff too, right? When they left Egypt. Continuing, and every man whom was found blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and goat's hair and ram's skin, skins dyed red and seal skins, brought them. Everyone that did offer an offering of silver and brass brought the Lord's offering, and every man with whom was found acacia or a shale wood, I think it's acacia, I don't know, acacia, it's wood, for any work of the service brought it. And all the women that were wise-hearted did spin with their hands and brought that which they had spun, the blue and the purple and the scarlet and the fine linen. And all the women whose hearts stirred them up, notice, you know, that desire is in there. They're getting stirred up. They gotta do what they feel they are there to do. You know, Esther, you know, could it be like such a time as this? You're here? You know, thanks, Mordecai. And then she went on away, of course. Continuing, and all the women whose hearts stirred them up in wisdom spun the goat's hair. And the rulers brought the onyx stones and the stones to be set for the ephod and for the breastplate and the spice and the oil for the light and for the anointing oil and for the sweet incense. Of course, this is from Exodus chapter 35, verses 23 to 28. And the Revised Version. Now, today's Revised Standard Version, I'll use it on occasion for my own personal studies, looking up the way, you know how the King James sometimes will say something and it's kind of hard to understand it in today's language. And I might go as far as to check out the same Bible that Ellen White would use, because just for the mere sake of finding out another way of saying it. But it has to stay in context. It has to stay without corruption. I won't hold a revised version in my hands and preach from it, because I know there's some problems in that book. But if you have discernment and wisdom and understanding of the scriptures, you'll know, because I've run across this a couple of times when I've, like with the RSV, for example, because this eSort software sometimes allows you to have all these different versions in there, and you check, and you notice, wow, I mean, you're way off on that one, you know? Like, the NIV is infamous for that. You'll go to see a verse, because I used to use the NIV years ago before I was a Sabbath keeper. And, I mean, usually you'll just find out the verse is not even there. The number's even missing. But sometimes the verse is there, and it's just totally says a complete turnaround. I show that on my Bogus Bibles page. And the only problems that I could find in the King James Version is the punctuation. And there are some words that could have been translated better, like for, like the daily sacrifice, for example, in Daniel's book, chapter 8. It's not what you think. The daily is actually speaking of a covenant, which means the seventh-day Sabbath. Check that out sometimes when you get a chance. I'm thinking of doing a study on that. Mike Schiffer did a study on it a while ago, and he sent me his notes on it, and he says, the daily of Daniel's been cracked. And I said, but it took me a month or two just to get around to reading it because it was kind of a big article, and I thought, whoa, he hit it right on the head, because whenever you look at the word sacrifice in the daily next to that verse, it's not supposed to be there. It's bracketed. So they just assumed it was talking about the daily sacrifice, but it wasn't. It was talking about the daily, which is actually a mistranslation. It should have been the covenant. Amen, Brother Chris. And Hebrews chapter 4, verse 9, the word rest should be a keeping Sabbath. I agree with you there. So I have a tendency to believe in some areas, the King James being as close a match as you can get with the Dead Sea Scrolls, you're a lot safer there. But having the line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little, already ensconced on the heart of the Christian, Hebrews chapter 4, verse 9 is not going to get past them. They're going to notice the word rest, and they're going to look it up, and they're going to find out that the actual translated word is from, it should be a keeping Sabbath, which is the actual word means, or the actual word is sabbatismo, that they translate it to the just plain rest. Which is amazing to me, because when you start off in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 8, and I think it's up in verse 1 or 2 or 3, where it says, speaking of the seventh day on this wise. I mean, it starts right off telling you what it's talking about, but yet they still pushed it as just put the word rest there, because Sunday keepers were involved. And I'm sure you do, Brother Chris. I've got a few more too, but I just still think the King James is a lot safer, as I'm sure, you know, many will. But having the this sermon that we have, like I said, the line upon line thing, it's just not going to get past us, some of these things. The punctuation, that was one of the first things I noticed, especially when Jesus was talking to the thief on the cross, and then 3 days later, he's talking to Mary, telling her that, you know, don't touch me, I've not yet ascended to my Father. And I'm thinking, whoa, wait a second here. 3 days ago, you told the thief on the cross you were going to go to paradise that day. Then I found out that the comma was in the wrong spot. And found out later that punctuation was added years after that Bible was published. So, continuing. While the building of the sanctuary was in progress, the people, old and young, men and women and children, continued to bring their offerings until those in charge of the work found that they had enough. Okay, stop here. and even more than they could use. I don't know if she's going to go into this, but they actually told them to stop giving, right? Could you imagine? I mean, seriously, sit down for a minute and just started gazing at the ceiling. Could you imagine for a split second TBN or any church on earth, except, of course, the remnant, they would say, whoa, hold on, stop sending money. We've got what we need. I mean, seriously, could you see that happening in today's world? No. No, that's not going to happen. So anyway, continuing. And Moses caused to be proclaimed throughout the camp, let neither man nor woman make any more work for the offering of the sanctuary. There, so she did mention it. So the people were restrained from bringing. The murmurings of the Israelites and the visitation of God's judgments because of their sins are recorded as a warning to after generations. All who love the worship of God and prize the blessing of His sacred presence will manifest the same spirit of sacrifice in preparing a house where He may meet with them. They will desire to bring to the Lord an offering of the very best that they possess. This kind of stuff could convict the hearts of many when you think about it, especially when you, now the way we're set up now. Where could we set up a church? I mean, seriously, see you on Sabbath? Oh, some of you, it's going to take you 3 days just to get here? Seriously, you can't. The way our numbers are so scattered, it's a little bit more strategic if you look at it the right way. The way our Father is able to have us scattered the way we are. And I have no doubt that the church will go out the same way it came in. It started in the homes. It's going to leave in the homes. You know, the little home churches. I mean, look at Olsteen. What is it, 150,000 members in his church? What was it? Is that 150,000, right? Or am I going way off the deep end there? Or the guy at Willow Creek, My sister Mariette used to go there. She doesn't go there anymore. 5,000 seats. Okay, 15,000? 5,000 seats in this one guy's in Battle Creek, or Willow Creek. And that guy was best friends with William Jefferson Clinton. They kept having these meetings. I mean, come on. Clinton, a man who was educated by the Jesuits at Georgetown University, who has all the red flags of a Jesuit, or short-robed, if you will, but still, a Jesuit like Pat Robertson, a short-robed. Well, Pat Robertson's more a short-robed than Clinton would be, because Clinton's actually married. But the I can very easily see what's, you know, without even rose-colored glasses, like many of you know exactly what I'm talking about here. This is why you had the 3,000 and 4,000 and 5,000 and 10,000 seating in these churches, these mass churches, like the one out in Fowler, Indiana, that's like about 10, 15 miles from here. I mean, Fowler, Indiana, it's got like 3,000 people in the city, and that church can hold everybody in it. They just built one there for this little woman pastor. I don't know, I can't remember what her name is, but what's that doing there? It's an entertainment center is what it is. But it's also an ability, it gives them the ability to be able to control the masses. This is one of the reasons you see them flaunting the Romans 13 law about, you know, being subject to the higher powers all the time in the news, saying, you know, especially with the Katrina situation going down and having the pastors go out there to calm down the people. And using Romans 13, oh, you got to listen to the higher powers. Yeah. Well, what if the higher power is like Pharaoh? But it's just amazing how they got these massive churches. It allows them for mass hypnosis with their NLP, and for those of you that know what I'm talking about. Yeah, calm down and give me your guns. Good point. That's, yeah, what library girl just put in the room. And that's what they do. But this NLP, the neuro-linguistic programming, it's a form, a gentle form of mass hypnosis. They used to use parfuming. I used to mess with the occult before I was a Christian, so I know what parfuming is. And parfuming, well, some modern witches might even call it perfuming. Yeah, but that's what the word perfume comes from, ladies. The perfume, the parfuming technique or spell, if you will, it allows for when they smell something, it brings them into, it's like a song. If you haven't heard the song in 20 or 30 years, it all of a sudden brings you into a nostalgic and you start to drift off. And when you're in that mindset, if you will, then the pastor on the pulpit starts really pumping all sorts of garbage into your head. Because they can tell. He's standing there. It's all you people, like, well, not you guys. What I'm saying, if anybody's listening that goes to these kind of churches, you're all sitting there looking at him. You don't realize what he's seeing. He's seeing a bunch of dazed faces when he gets about 10 minutes into it. 8 to 10 minutes into it with an NLP, he'll see about 10, you know, he'll see a bunch of dazed faces. What they used to do at this one church, the Midwest Christian Center in Tinley Park, Illinois, where I used to go. I wasn't a member or nothing like that. I used to go there, but you know, when I got rededicated to the Lord, this is before I was even keeping Sabbath. This is like, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. And he used to use the parfuming way up in the rafters. And I found out about this. He had a can of aerosol every 20 feet. This is a huge church. It had, you know, like 3,000 seats. It was like an auditorium. And at a specific time in the service, he would give some kind of a sign, like touch his nose or something, I don't know. And the guys in the back would hit the button, and those aerosol cans would just release this perfume all over the crowd. It would take a good 30 seconds, maybe 45 seconds, for it to drift down and actually reach the people down below. And he knew this. And so he would push his sermon toward that end, so that when he sees the sea of dazed faces. Okay, now they're primed and ready. Now start dropping the perfume. The witches do this. It gives them an opportunity to throw spells and stuff. And it's not so much he's throwing a spell. It's that everybody's in a mindset now where he has better control over them in a mass method, where he can, you know, hypnotize, if you will. That's witchcraft. I don't know if you know that, but hypnotism is a form of witchcraft. And so it's pretty amazing how people will sit, and or sheeple, if you will actually sit and allow people to do this to them. But faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. So if people don't want to stay in the scriptures, they're not going to be ready for stuff like this. It's just like with the prophecies that we speak of. Most of the people I run into have no idea. Certain things were already spoken of in the scriptures, and it's that blunt and it's that accurate. Well, then just show them Amos chapter 8, verse 11. They'll know. Oh, you mean because I haven't been reading my Bible I don't catch this? Continuing. A house built for God should not be left in debt, for he is thereby dishonored. An amount sufficient to accomplish the work should be freely given, that the workmen may be able to say, as did the builders of the tabernacle, bring no more offerings. Again, words you will never hear again outside the remnant church. Continuing, the tabernacle was so constructed that it could be taken apart and borne with the Israelites in all their journeyings. That's amazing in itself. She goes on to say that it was therefore small, being not more than 55 feet in length and 18 in breadth and height. Yet, it was a magnificent structure. The wood employed for the building and its furniture was that of the acacia tree, I guess, which was less subject to decay than any other to be obtained at Sinai. Kind of reminds me of the hedge trees we have in the back. We got a little forest on the back of our land here. And if anybody knows what a hedge tree is, it's about as close to living petrified rock that I can think of. Or petrified wood. Living petrified wood. It's amazing. It could lay there, it'll fall over, and as it's laying on its side after it fell over from dying, branches will shoot straight up and it'll start growing again. I don't get it. But the reason I say it's like petrified, you've got to have a diamond tip chainsaw to get through it. It's like cutting stone. It's an amazing wood. It burns really, really hot too in a wood burn. And it's like I would imagine this is like the acacia tree. It would take forever to rot, I would think. Because this wood is not, I mean, it's been laying down. You could tell it's been laying down. These are massive trees, and there's no mold. It's not falling apart and brittle. You know how some trees will fall over, and you're walking through the woods, and you step on them, and it looks like a perfectly nice log, and you step on it, and your foot goes right through it. Yeah, it ain't going to happen with a hedge tree. Yeah, because we got a bunch of other trees in the forest, too, that are falling next to it, and they're all just all, I mean, you can grab them, your fingers go right through them. And then you got all these cool little bugs running around. So, continuing. The walls consisted of upright boards set in silver sockets and held firm by pillars and connecting bars, and all were overlaid with gold, giving to the building the appearance of solid gold. Wow. Imagine that on a sunny day. The roof was formed of four sets of curtains, the innermost of fine twined linen in blue and purple and scarlet, with cherubim of cunning work. Because these guys were blessed with these abilities as a gift from God to do this cunning carvings that they did of these angels, these cherubim. Going on, she says, the other three respectively were of goat's hair, ram's skins dyed red, and seal's skins, so arranged as to afford complete protection. Let me scroll down. The building was divided into two apartments by a rich and a beautiful curtain or veil suspended from gold-plated pillars, and a similar veil closed the entrance of the first apartment. These, like the inner covering, which formed the ceiling, were of the most gorgeous colors, blue, purple, and scarlet, beautifully arranged, while inwrought with threads of gold and silver were cherubim to represent the angelic host who are connected with the work of the heavenly sanctuary and who are ministering spirits to the people of God on earth. Could you imagine that? This thing is, it's got gold and silver wire, if you will. I mean, really thin wire, like interwoven with it. It's a heavy, heavy curtain. What did it take? Now, I'm thinking of the curtain that they had in the actual, when it was finally finished, when Solomon built it, thanks to David gathering all the materials. That, you know, the one that the Lord split in two when Jesus died on the cross, what was it, like 60 men or something like that it took to raise it? It was massive. It was huge. But it was thick and heavy because of I would imagine it had a little bit of weight on it, too, because of all the blood on it, too. But I think it was 60 men, or maybe it was more. I can't remember exactly, but I know it wasn't just a couple of guys pulling that thing up there. Continuing, she says that the sacred tent was enclosed in an open space called the court, which was surrounded by hangings or screens of fine linen suspended from pillars of brass. The entrance of this enclosure was at the eastern end. It was closed by curtains of costly material and beautiful workmanship, though inferior to those of the sanctuary. The hangings of the court, being only about half as high as the walls of the tabernacle, the building could be plainly seen by the people without. In the court, and the nearest the entrance, stood the brazen altar of burnt offering. Upon this altar were consumed all the sacrifices made by fire unto the Lord, and its horns were sprinkled with the atoning blood. Between the altar and the door of the tabernacle was the laver, which was also the brass, made from the mirrors that had been the freewill offering of the women of Israel. At the laver, the priests were to wash their hands and their feet whenever they went into the sacred apartments or approached the altar to offer a burnt offering unto the Lord. Let me scroll up a little bit. Yeah, how many people are reading tonight? Just thought I'd ask. But continuing, in the first apartment or holy place were where the table of showbread, the candlestick or lampstand, and the altar of incense. The table of showbread stood on the north with its ornamental crown. It was overlaid with pure gold. On this table, the priests each Sabbath to place 12 cakes arranged in two piles and sprinkled with frankincense. The loaves that were removed, being accounted holy, were to be eaten by the priests. On the south was the seven-branched candlestick with its seven lamps. Its branches were ornamented with exquisitely wrought flowers resembling lilies, and the whole was made from one solid piece of gold. There being no windows in the tabernacle, the lamps were never all extinguished at one time, but shed their light by day and by night, just before the veil separating the holy place from the most holy in the immediate presence of God, which is, of course, the Shekinah glory, the golden altar of incense. Upon this altar, the priest was to burn incense every morning and evening. Its horns were touched with the blood of the sin offering, and it was sprinkled with blood upon the great day of atonement. The fire upon this altar was kindled by God himself and was sacredly cherished. Day and night, the holy incense diffused its fragrance throughout the sacred apartments and without far around the tabernacle. Amen. Thank you.
All right. We'll continue on, but you know, just to give you an example of how fine, if you haven't studied the sanctuary thing, how fine the details are there, you know, a couple paragraph or so up, Nick read that the entrance was faced the east. There's a reason for that. If you read, I think it was in Ezekiel when he showed the greatest abomination, which was the leaders of the leaders of the church, I guess, of Israel, standing with their backs to the sanctuary facing the rising sun. And to enter the sanctuary, you actually had to have your back to the rising sun to face where the Lord's holy place was. But just myriads of details in this picture that is being painted right now. It's just amazing, really amazing. To continue, beyond the inner veil was the Holy of Holies, where centered the symbolic service of atonement and intercession, and which formed the connecting link between heaven and earth. In this apartment was the ark, a chest of acacia wood, overlaid within and without with gold, and having a crown of gold about the top. It was made as a depository for the tables of stone upon which God himself had inscribed the Ten Commandments. Hence, it was called the Ark of God's Testament, or the Ark of the Covenant. Since the Ten Commandments were the basis of the covenant made between God and Israel, the cover of the sacred chest was called the Mercy Seat. This was wrought on one solid piece of gold and was surmounted by a golden cherubim, one standing on each end. One wing of each angel was stretched forth on high, while the other was folded over the body. See Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 11. Sabbath blessings there, Gary. Glad you could join us. Hope you're feeling better. in the tokens of reverence and humility, the position of the cherubim with their faces turned towards each other and looking reverently downward toward the ark represents the reverence with which the heavenly host regard the law of God and their interest in the plan of redemption. Above the mercy seat was the Shekinah, the manifestation of the divine presence. And from between the cherubim, God made known his will. Divine messages were sometimes communicated to the high priest by a voice from the cloud. Sometimes a light fell upon the angel at the right to signify or approval or acceptance, or a shadow or cloud rested upon the one on the left to reveal disapproval or rejection. The law of God enshrined within the ark was the great rule of righteousness and judgment. That law pronounced death upon the transgressor. But above the law was the mercy seat, upon which the presence of God was revealed, and from which, by virtue of the atonement, pardon was granted to the repentant sinner. Thus, in the work of Christ for our redemption, symbolized by the sanctuary service, mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. From Psalms 85, verse 10. No language can describe the glory of the scene presented within the sanctuary. The gold-plated walls reflected the light from the golden candlestick, the brilliant hues of richly embroidered curtains with their shining angels, the table and the altar of incense glittering with gold. Beyond the second veil, the sacred ark, with its mystic cherubim, and above it, the holy Shekinah, the visible manifestation of Jehovah's presence. All but a dim reflection of the glories of the temple of God in heaven, the great center of the work for man's redemption. A period of about a half a year was occupied in building the tabernacle. When it was completed, Moses examined all the work of the builders, comparing it with the pattern shown him in the mount, and the directions he'd received from God. As the Lord had commanded, even so had they done it, and Moses blessed them. With eager interest, the multitudes of Israel crowded around to look upon the sacred structure. While they were contemplating the scene with great satisfaction, the pillar of cloud floated over the sanctuary and descending enveloped it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. There was a revealing of the divine majesty, and for a time, even Moses could not enter. Okay, let me finish this little blurb there and start, LG. With deep emotion, the people beheld the token that the work of their hands was accepted. There were no loud demonstrations of rejoicing. A solemn awe rested upon all. But the gladness of their hearts welled up tears of joy, and they murmured low, earnest words of gratitude that God had consented to abide with them.
Okay, continuing on. By divine direction, the tribe of Levi was set apart for the service of the sanctuary. In the earliest times, every man was the priest of his own household. In the days of Abraham, the priesthood was regarded as the birthright of the eldest son. Now, instead of the firstborn of all Israel, the Lord accepted the tribe of Levi for the work of the sanctuary. By this signal honor, he manifested his approval of their fidelity, both in adhering to his service and in executing his judgment when Israel apostatized in the worship of the golden calf. The priesthood, however, was restricted to the family of Aaron. Aaron and his sons alone were permitted to minister before the Lord. The rest of the tribe were entrusted with the charge of the tabernacle and its furniture, and they were to attend upon the priests in their ministration, but they were not to sacrifice, to burn incense, or to see the holy things till they were covered. In accordance with their office, a special dress was appointed for the priests. Thou shalt make holy garments for Aaron, thy brother, for glory and for beauty, was the divine direction to Moses. The robe of the common priest was of white linen and woven in one piece. It extended nearly to the feet and was confined about the waist by a white linen girdle embroidered in blue, purple, and red. A linen turban or mitre completed his outer costume. Moses, at the burning bush was directed to put off his sandals, for the ground whereon he stood was holy. So the priests were not to enter the sanctuary with shoes upon their feet. Particles of dust cleaving to them would desecrate the holy place. They were to leave their shoes in the court before entering the sanctuary, and also to wash both their hands and their feet before ministering in the tabernacle or at the altar of burnt offering. Thus was constantly taught the lesson that all defilement must be put away from those who would approach into the presence of God. The garments of the high priest were of costly material and beautiful workmanship, befitting his exalted station. In addition to the linen dress of the common priest, he wore a robe of blue, also woven in one piece. Around the skirt it was ornamented with golden bells and pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet. Outside of this was the ephod, a shorter garment of gold, blue, purple, scarlet, and white. It was confined by a girdle of the same colors, beautifully wrought. The ephod was sleeveless, and on its gold-embroidered shoulder pieces were set two onyx stones bearing the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Over the ephod was the breastplate, the most sacred of the priestly vestments. This was of the same material as the ephod. It was in the form of a square measuring a span and was suspended from the shoulders by a cord of blue from golden rings. The border was formed of a variety of precious stones, the same that form the 12 foundations of the city of God. Within the border were 12 stones set in gold, arranged in rows of four, and like those in the shoulder pieces, engraved with the names of the tribe. The Lord's direction was, Aaron shall bear the names of the children of Israel in the breastplate of judgment upon his heart, when he goeth in unto the holy place for a memorial before the Lord continually. Exodus 28, verse 29. So Christ, the great high priest, pleading his blood before the Father in the sinner's behalf, bears upon his heart the name of every repentant, believing soul. Says the psalmist, I am poor and needy, yet the Lord thinketh upon me. Psalm 40, verse 17. At the right and left of the breastplate were two large stones of great brilliancy. These were known as the Urim and Thummim. By them, the will of God was made known through the high priest. When questions were brought for decision before the Lord, a halo of light encircling the precious stone at the right was a token of the divine consent or approval, while a cloud shadowing the stone at the left was an evidence of denial or disapprobation. The mitre of the high priest consisted of the white linen turban, having attached to it by a lace of blue, a gold plate bearing the inscription, Holiness to Jehovah. Everything connected with the apparel and deportment of the priest was to be such as to impress the beholder with a sense of the holiness of God, the sacredness of his worship, and the purity required of those who came into his presence.
Not only the sanctuary itself, but the manifestation or the ministration of the priest was to serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things. Hebrews 8:5. Thus it was of great importance, and the Lord, through Moses, gave the most definite and explicit instruction concerning every point of this typical service. The ministration of the sanctuary consisted of two divisions, a daily and a yearly service. The daily service was performed at the altar of burning of burnt offering, in the court of the tabernacle and in the holy place, while the yearly service was in the most holy. No mortal eye but that of the high priest was to look upon the inner apartment of the sanctuary. Only once a year could the priest enter there, and that after the most careful and solemn preparation. With trembling he went in before God, and the people in reverent silence awaited his return, their hearts uplifted in earnest prayer for the divine blessing. Before the mercy seat, the high priest made the atonement for Israel, and in the cloud of glory God met with him. His stay here beyond the accustomed time filled them with fear, lest because of their sins, or his own, he had been slain by the glory of the Lord. The daily service consisted of the morning and evening burnt offering, the offering of sweet incense on the golden altar, and the special offerings for individual sins. And there was also offerings for Sabbaths, new moons, and special feasts. Every morning and evening a lamb of a year old was burned upon the altar with its appropriate meat offering, thus symbolizing the daily consecration of the nation to Jehovah and their constant dependence upon the atoning blood of Christ. God expressly directed that every offering presented for the service of the sanctuary should be without blemish, from Exodus 12:5. The priests were to examine all animals brought as a sacrifice and were to reject everyone in which a defect was discovered. Only an offering without blemish could be a symbol of his perfect purity, who was to offer himself as a lamb without blemish and without spot, from 1 Peter 1:19. The Apostle Paul points to these sacrifices as an illustration of what the followers of Christ are to become. He says, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service," Romans 12:1. We are to give ourselves to the service of God, and we should seek to make the offering as nearly perfect as possible. God will not be pleased with anything less than the best we can offer. Those who love him with all the heart will desire to give him the best service of the life, and they will be constantly seeking to bring every power of their being into harmony with the laws that will promote their ability to do his will. In the offering of the incense, the priest was brought more directly into the presence of God than in any other act of the daily ministration. As the inner veil of the sanctuary did no extend to the top, to the top of the building, the glory of God, which was manifested above the mercy seat, was partially visible from the first apartment. When the priest offered incense before the Lord, he looked toward the ark, and as the cloud of incense arose, the divine glory descended upon the mercy seat and filled the most holy place, and often so filled both apartments that the priest was obliged to retire to the door of the tabernacle. As in that typical service, the priest looked by faith to the mercy seat, which he could not see, so the people of God are now to direct their prayers to Christ, the great high priest, who, unseen by human vision, is pleading in their behalf in the sanctuary above. The incense ascending with the prayers of Israel represents the merits and intercession of Christ, his perfect righteousness, which through faith is imputed to his people, and which can alone make the worship of sinful beings acceptable to God. Before the veil of the most holy place was an altar of perpetual intercession. Before the holy, an altar of continual atonement. By blood and by incense, God was to be approached, symbols pointing to the great mediator, through whom sinners may approach Jehovah, and through whom alone mercy and salvation can be granted to the repentant, believing soul, right before page 352, Brother Nick. As the priests, morning and evening, entered the holy place at the time of incense, the daily sacrifice was ready to be offered upon the altar in the court without. This was a time of intense interest to the worshipers who assembled at the tabernacle. Before entering into the presence of God, through the ministration of the priests, they were to engage in earnest searching of heart and confession of sin. They united in silent prayer with their faces toward the holy place. Thus their petitions ascended with the cloud of incense, while faith laid hold upon the merits of the promised Savior, prefigured by the atoning sacrifice. The hours appointed for the morning and the evening sacrifice were regarded as sacred, and they came to be observed as a set of worship throughout the Jewish nation.
To continue, and when in later times the Jews were scattered as captives in distant lands, they still at the appointed hour turned their faces toward Jerusalem and offered up their petitions to the God of Israel. In this custom, Christians have an example for morning and evening prayer. While God condemns a mere round of ceremonies without the spirit of worship, he looks with great pleasure upon those who love him, bowing mornings and evenings to seek pardon for sins committed and to present the request for needed blessings. The showbread was kept ever before the Lord as a perpetual offering. Thus it was part of the daily sacrifice. It was called showbread, or bread of the presence, because it was ever before the face of the Lord. It was an acknowledgement of man's dependence upon God for both temporal and spiritual food, and that it is received only through the mediation of Christ. God had fed Israel in the wilderness with bread from heaven, and they were still dependent upon his bounty, both for temporal food and spiritual blessings. Both the manna and the showbread pointed to Christ, the living bread, who is ever in the presence of God for us. He himself said, "I am the living bread which came down from heaven," from John 6:48 through 51. Frankincense was placed upon the loaves. When the bread was removed every Sabbath to be replaced by fresh loaves, the frankincense was burned upon the altar as a memorial before God. The most important part of the daily ministration was the service performed on behalf of individuals. The repentant sinner brought his offerings to the door of the tabernacle and, placing his hand upon the victim's head, confessed his sins, thus in figure transferring them from himself to the innocent sacrifice. By his own hand, the animal was then slain, and the blood was carried by the priest to the holy place and sprinkled before the veil, behind which was the ark containing the law that the sinner had transgressed. By this ceremony, the sin was, through the blood, transferred in figure to the sanctuary. In some cases, the blood was not taken directly into the holy place. And it has a note, it says, see appendix note 6. But the flesh was then to be eaten by the priest, as Moses directed the sons of Aaron, saying, "God hath given it to you to bear the iniquity of the congregation." That's from Leviticus chapter 10, verse 17. Both ceremonies alike symbolize the transfer of the sin from the penitent to the sanctuary. Such was the work that went on day by day throughout the year. The sins of Israel being thus transferred to the sanctuary, the holy places were defiled, and a special work became necessary for the removal of sins. God commanded that an atonement be made for each of the sacred apartments, as for the altar, to cleanse it and hallow it from the uncleanliness of the children of Israel, from Leviticus 16, chapter 16, verse 19. Once a year on the great day of atonement, the priest entered the most holy place for the cleansing of the sanctuary. The work there performed completed the yearly round of ministration. On the day of atonement, two kids of the goats were brought to the door of the tabernacle, and lots were cast upon them, one lot for the Lord and the other for the scapegoat. The goat upon which the first lot fell was to be slain as a sin offering for the people, and the priest was to bring his blood within the veil and sprinkle it upon the mercy seat. and he shall make an atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanliness of the children of Israel, and because of their transgression in all their sins, and so shall he do for the tabernacle of the congregation that remaineth among them in the midst of their uncleanliness. And Aaron shall lay both hands upon the head of the live goat and confess over him all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions in all their sins, putting them upon the head of the goat, and shall send him away by the hand of a fit man into the wilderness. And the goat shall bear upon him all their iniquities into a land not inhabited. That also is foretelling something that we hear about in Revelation. The 1,000 years, I believe, or the millennium, that people want to call it. Not until the goat had been thus sent away did the people regard themselves as freed from the burden of their sins. Every man was to afflict his soul while the work of atonement was going forward. All business was laid aside, and the whole congregation of Israel spent the day in solemn humiliation before God, with prayer, fasting, and deep searching of heart. Important truths concerning the atonement were taught the people by this yearly service. In the sin offerings presented during the year, a substitute had been accepted in the sinner's stead, but the blood of the victim had not made full atonement for the sin. It only provided a means by which the sin was transferred to the sanctuary. By the offering of blood, the sinner acknowledged the authority of the law, confessed the guilt of his transgression, and expressed his faith in him who was to take away the sin of the world. But he was not entirely released from the condemnation of the law. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest, having taken an offering for the congregation, went into the most holy place with the blood and sprinkled it upon the mercy seat above the tables of the law. Thus the claims of the law, which demanded the life of the sinner, were satisfied. Then, in his character of mediator, the priest took the sins upon himself, and leaving the sanctuary, he bore with him the burden of Israel's guilt. And again, all this, man, this prefigures exactly what Jesus did. You know, this whole sanctuary is the gospel and the plan of salvation in picture form. It's really nice. At the door of the tabernacle, he laid his hands upon the head of the scapegoat and confessed over him all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions and all their sins, putting them upon the head of the goat. And as the goat bearing these sins was sent away, they were with him regarded as forever separated from the people. Such was the service performed unto the example and shadow of heavenly things. And that's from Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5. There you go, Brother Nick.
Thank you. All right. As has been stated, the earthly sanctuary was built by Moses according to the pattern shown him in the mount. It was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices. Its two holy places were patterns of things in the heavens. Christ, our great high priest, is a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 9, 23, and chapter 8, verse 2 confirms that. As in vision, the apostle John was granted a view of the temple of God in heaven. He beheld there seven lamps of fire burning before the throne. He saw an angel having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. Revelation 4, verses 5, and then Revelation 8, verse 3. Here the prophet was permitted to behold the first apartment of the sanctuary in heaven, and he saw there the seven lamps of fire, and the golden altar, represented by the golden candlestick and the altar of incense in the sanctuary on earth. Again, the temple of God was opened, Revelation 11, verse 19. And he looked within the inner veil upon the Holy of Holies. Here he beheld the Ark of the Testament, Revelation 11, 19, represented by the sacred chest constructed by Moses to contain the law of God. Let me scroll up. Moses made the earthly sanctuary according to the fashion that he had seen. Paul declares that the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry, when completed, were the patterns of things in the heavens, Acts 7, verse 44, and Hebrews 9, verses 21 and 23. And John says that he saw the sanctuary in heaven. That sanctuary in which Jesus ministers in our behalf is the great original, of which the sanctuary built by Moses was a copy. The heavenly temple, the abiding place of the King of Kings, where thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him, Daniel 7, verse 10. That temple filled with the glory of the eternal throne, where seraphim, its shining guardians, veil their faces in adoration, no earthly structure could represent its vastness and its glory. Yet, important truths concerning the heavenly sanctuary and the great work there carried forward for man's redemption were to be taught by the earthly sanctuary and its services. After his ascension, our Savior was to begin his work as our high priest, says Paul. Or, says Paul, Christ is not entered into the holy places made with hands, which are the figures of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 24. Catholic Church like to take that one out of account. Well, they actually totally removed that one from their doctrinal books because of the host, the Eucharist, or the ritual, if you will, of transubstantiation, where they assume Jesus Christ is actually in that little wafer or cookie made by human hands, even though the Bible says that he is not entering into holy places made with hands. Even if it was a holy place, I mean, it's not. That little cookie is nothing. Going on, as Christ's ministration was to consist of two great divisions, each occupying a period of time and having a distinctive place in the heavenly sanctuary, so the typical ministration consisted of two divisions, the daily and the yearly service, and to each department of the tabernacle was devoted. As Christ at his ascension appeared in the presence of God to plead his blood in behalf of penitent believers, so the priests in the daily ministration sprinkled the blood of the sacrifice in the holy place in the sinner's behalf. It's one big, giant, proleptic perspective is all it really is, the sanctuary itself. It's like writing a check. You know, you walk into a store and you go to purchase an item. This is back in the days when they used to use checks, you know. And you walk into the store and you hand them a check. Did you hand them any cash? No, but you still got the item. Well, when they came in there with the lamb sacrifice, they offered the sacrifice and they got the forgiveness, even though it wasn't totally finished until the actual act, when the Lamb of God has taken away the sins of the world actually was on the cross. But it's just like that writing a check thing. You get it in advance. Well, back then. Now we're looking back to the cross. They used to look forward to the cross. All right, continuing. The blood of Christ, while it was to release the repentant sinner from the condemnation of the law, was not to cancel the sin. It would stand on record in the sanctuary until the final atonement. So in the type, the blood of the sin offering removed the sin from the penitent, but it rested in the sanctuary until the day of atonement. In the great day of final award, the dead are to be judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works, Revelation 20, verse 12. Then, by virtue of the atoning blood of Christ, the sins of all the truly penitent will be blotted from the books of heaven. Thus, the sanctuary will be freed or cleansed from the record of sin. In the type, this great work of atonement, or blotting out of sins, was represented by the services of the Day of Atonement, the cleansing of the earthly sanctuary, which was accomplished by the removal, by virtue of the blood of the sin offering, of the sins by which it had been polluted. Let me reread that. The cleansing of the earthly sanctuary, which was accomplished by the removal, by the virtue of the blood of the sin offering, of the sins by which it had been polluted. So, continuing, as in the final atonement, the sins of the truly penitent are to be blotted from the records of heaven, no more to be remembered or come into mind. So in the type, they were borne away into the wilderness, forever separated from the congregation. Since Satan is the originator of sin, the direct instigator of all the sins that caused the death of the Son of God, justice demands that Satan shall suffer the final punishment. Christ's work for the redemption of men and purification of the universe from sin will be closed by the removal of sin from the heavenly sanctuary and the placing of these sins upon Satan, who will bear the final penalty. So, in the typical service, the yearly round of ministration closed with the purification of the sanctuary and the confessing of the sins on the head of the scapegoat. Thus, in the ministration of the tabernacle and of the temple that afterward took its place, the people were taught each day the great truths relative to Christ's death and ministration, and once each year their minds were carried forward to the closing events of the great controversy between Christ and Satan, the final purification of the universe from sin and sinners. And I can't wait for that day, just like most Christians can't, you know, when it's no longer that little whispering tempter. You know, he's gone, he's dead, he's deceased, it's all past and present. And praise the Lord for his mercy. So much involved in it. I mean, he loves us so much. I mean, he's just looking at that sanctuary. There is just so much in there that he has done for us.